Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more. We have a very diverting show for you this week. We're going to talk to critic Stephen Garrett about a couple of recent releases, The Fall Guy and Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, both of which are in theaters now. And we're also going to talk to Book and Film Globe contributor Chris Farnsworth about Sugar, a series on Apple Plus starring Colin Farrell, which is one of the most surprising and genre-bending TV programs of the year. Very interesting, very entertaining. I think you'll like it. And we'll be right back to talk to Stephen about The Fall Guy right after this interlude.
This film has everything.
Everything?
Do you want to make out? Or?
Nope.
I guess.
This does not seem safe!
Feel like sexy bacon.
You need carbs!
I'm not buying it.
The Fall Guy is in theaters now, and Stephen Garrett is our own personal Fall Guy. He does his own.
I'll take the fall. Yeah. I feel like I'm going to take the fall on this movie, actually.
Oh, for sure. He does his own stunts.
He walks
through the streets of New York City every day without a stunt double. I reviewed The Fall Guy for Book and Film Globe, and I think we're going to have an old-fashioned difference of opinion on this movie, Stephen. You're kind of a fan of The Fall Guy.
I'm a fan, man. I fell for it. Mm. Hey, did you introduce the segment with the original theme song to Glenn A. Larson's show?
I don't know if we're allowed to use musical cues, but that was my favorite part. There's the closing credits sequence when they showed the actual stunts that they were doing in the movie, and of which there are many, many, many types of stunts and very, very well executed to the tune of the old theme song. You know, the thing about the old Fall Guy TV show, I don't know if you remember watching it or not.
I was a big fan. I love that show.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, like, the Lee Majors is Colt Seavers. He was a bounty hunter.
He was.
You know?
He was a bounty hunter. That's true.
He was a bounty hunter.
Different. And, like, no romance.
No romance. The whole vibe was like about this bounty hunter going up against corrupt sheriffs. You know, it was a very, very like 80s TV show. And I understand that, you know, we're 40 years past that now, but there's none of that like vibe here. I felt like this version of the Fall Guy is so wink, wink, nudge, nudge, you know, purports to be like a satire of Hollywood, but really is kind of just an example of a bloated Hollywood movie in its own right, which isn't to say the stunts aren't cool, because there are some very fun, you know, last half hour was great. You know, there was this helicopter thing, and there was a Miami Vice style boat chase, and, you know, there was some fun car stuff. There were dog stunts, but I felt like that was all kind of packed in at the end, and the first half was just so, I felt like it was just this dreary wink.
Dreary.
I felt it was dreary. I was bored out of my mind.
It was really? I felt it was like amped up and very like fun. It was fun.
Dreary is not the right word. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I could see that it was a bore if you're not into the fun that it's selling, you know?
Well, it was, to me, like, I felt like the script was a real mess, right?
Right.
The premise, yeah, dreary is definitely not the right word. The
contrived, premise is for sure. Contrived.
Contrived.
Very contrived.
The premise is that Colt Seavers, who is the world's greatest stuntman, has an accident. He's played by Ryan Gosling, he has an accident, and so he retires from being a stuntman, but he's called out of retirement because his ex-girlfriend, Jody, is editing this picture in Australia. Everything's in Australia now because I think they offer.
She's not editing. She's filming. She's directing.
She's directing.
Making
she's
her debut.
Getting her directing debut. It's a cheesy sci-fi picture called Metal Storm. That's kind of like Mad Max meets Edge of Tomorrow meets Battlefield Earth.
Right. Well, that's very well put. Yeah.
A crappy Hollywood movie. And the star of the movie has gone missing. And Ryan Gosling is his stunt double. It's very contrived. And then there's a mystery that is very silly. And I just felt like, well, first of all, let's be clear, like Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt are the two leads. And for all their purported chemistry, I didn't feel like they actually had a lot of chemistry. They're just kind of these two very good looking movie stars. But the two, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't really feel any chemistry. And a lot of their conversations actually happen on the phone.
Yeah.
Which is odd considering they're staying at the same hotel.
Well, okay. Yeah, it's a good point. And you brought that up in your review. And I wasn't bothered by it, but when you pointed it out, I did realize, oh yeah, there wasn't a lot of screen time together. I do wonder if that's the director, the producer of the film, director David Leitch, or one of the producers saying, yeah, you know what? They don't really have that much chemistry together. We should maybe cut back the scenes with them. I thought the split screen thing that was very self-referential was kind of cute. And I liked that. It worked for me. I loved, you know, that first bit after he does the car stunt, which is where she realizes he's on the set. He is lured to the set in Australia with the idea that Emily Blunt has asked for him to be there when in fact it's the last person she wants to see. And so he realizes he's on a set where he's not welcome. Anyway, so that leads to the second stunt, which I thought was hilarious, where he keeps having to do this thing again and again, and then they have to describe the story back and forth, you know, in megaphones.
They keep blowing him into the wall. Yeah, but, you know,
blowing him into the wall, and what they're discussing is the movie, but the movie is actually, you know, kind of really their story and their dynamic, and the cast is sitting there kind of weighing in. I thought that was cute.
No. Two wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Absolutely not. Stupid screenwriting tricks. Just tell the story straight. And then there were some really weird asides. Like there's Stephanie Hsu, Oscar-nominated actress.
Wasted. I forgot she was in it.
Yeah, well, but she shows up and she's in a scene and then she's gone. My real problem, my biggest problem with this movie was it absolutely...
Was it Jean-Claude, the French dog? It was
Jean-Claude. No, of course not.
Jean-Claude was great. Attaque, Jean-Claude.
Of course it wasn't the dog, Stephen. No, I'm not anti-dog. I'm anti-Hannah Waddingham,
who
plays this...
She's scary.
She plays this producer of this movie, and she gets a lot... She's just... She wears this hideous brown wig, and she's sucking on a Diet Coke, and she's just... I mean, I saw a review referred to what she's doing in it as schmacting. and she's in it a lot, and there's a lot of cutaways. Well, they're also like there's the scene where the truck chase through the streets of Sydney.
I like that scene.
Yeah,
like
sure.
That? Intercut with the karaoke.
Intercut with the karaoke and the discussions at the bar. It was too. I just felt like that again. Like I just wanted to see the chase. I didn't care about the discussions. I didn't care about the relationships. I felt like, you know, it kept undermining itself. It kept trying to remind us that it was aware of its conventions. And I'm like, you know, it felt postmodern, but in a very dated kind of way. And I just did not like the screenplay. I would have liked a more straightforward adaptation. I hate to say it, you know. I just feel like this movie, and it's been unsuccessful relatively at the box office, and I think part of that's just a marketing problem, and also just like a, you know, it's a genre that doesn't have a clear audience because it's not really a straight action picture. It's not a rom-com. It's not based on an IP that anyone really cares about. I mean, yes, The Fall Guy did exist. But I hadn't thought about The Fall Guy in a long time. And I think about 80s TV a lot.
maybe that's the issue. An action romance is maybe, one of those genres that's very rare and hard to pull off. And, you know, either has to be a romance with a little action or an action film with a little bit of romance. It's trying to be both. And maybe that cancels itself out. I don't know.
But this is a problem with the genres. You know, when you had action romances in, let's say, the 80s and 90s, they were straightforward. They were action romances. You know, basically, it was like reading a pulp novel.
Action romance, though? You say it like
romancing the stone, for instance. I know. Well, I know. That's an old reference at this point.
I feel like that's a romance, you know, with a little action.
But here's what I'm saying is that you got these movies now, like The Lost City, that Channing Tatum thing. The Lost City, you have this. Argylle, to some extent, has I know that's a slightly different kind of movie, but you have these movies that are sort of genre mashups that involve a lot of action and then involve some romance and then involve some comedy, but the one thing I think that they all have in common, Stephen, is that there's a self-awareness on the part of the writing and on the part of the filmmaking that actually might have made the movies really fun to work on and really fun to make. Mm. But as an audience member, I find myself constantly yanked out of the experience by the supposed cleverness of the production team.
This is interesting, though. You know, like the movies are, this is a curious thing, isn't it? That these action romances seem to all be self-aware in a way that certainly you find annoying, and I wonder is problematic just for the genre, because Romancing the Stone was self-aware in its own way, you know?
In its own way, but it was like a pre-self-awareness, you know, like The Fall Guy just felt like a bro labor of love. And, you know, again, like, and yes, it's okay, it's a tribute to the stuntman, but the thing is, like, there's not, I feel like we could have had a little bit more about the mechanics of how these stunts work and how they're put together and how they train to do them. And instead it's just like, you know, we're just thrown into it and we're expected to admire the movie as much as it admires itself.
Right. I mean, you know, reminds me of that movie Hooper, right? You remember Hooper?
Yeah.
That was a real stuntman Valentine. And yes. I think that if there was a little bit, you know, this was a real opportunity for David Leitch to really make a wonderful kind of Valentine to the art and craft of stunt making, which is fascinating. And
yes.
Daredevilry that is never heralded or recognized the way it should be, right? We all take it for granted.
And so instead, we get a lot of cool stunts. And there's kind of that fun bit, you know, over the closing credits where you see the stunts actually being put together. But what you don't get is any real knowledge about how the craft works because the movie is too absorbed in itself. Yeah, I mean, The Hooper is a good example, which, you know, that's a dated Burt Reynolds movie at this point. But there was also a movie
and it still works, though.
It still works.
Hal Needham? Wasn't it Hal Needham?
Yeah, it was Hal Needham.
Who was a stuntman turned director?
Yeah, it was Hal Needham. And there was also a wonderful movie in the late 70s, early 80s called The Stuntman, starring Steve Railsback and Peter O'Toole, that had a similar vibe to it. And, you know, and was able to sort of, both those movies that were in that style of movie at the time were able to sort of tell a, you know, entertaining story with a lot of action, but without like beating us over the head with quote-unquote movie star chemistry and and like stupid screenwriting tricks.
Well, the stunt man was a really devilish movie, quite literally, right? I mean, the poster has Peter O'Toole with like a devil's tail, and that's a real mindfuck of a movie. Which is, you remember how he pulls that he does some mindfuck to Barbara Hershey that I remember to make her cry. That was very much like a movie about it was almost like an impish Day for Night. Anyway, I'm getting down a rabbit hole. You're right. I mean, this should have had a little bit more of the, like, if it's gonna celebrate stunt making and stunt men and women, let's see the craft a bit more instead of just see people who are resentful, like that trope of like the actor who's resentful because he doesn't do his own stunts, you know. Which comes up as a plot twist.
Yeah, it was so boring. But, it was so boring.
It's a little boring.
Boring and not funny. That said, if you like, you know, fun action sequences, this movie does have them, especially the last half hour. And I also will say that Metal Storm itself looks extremely fun. And I would rather go see Metal Storm starring Jason Momoa than The Fall Guy. That's what it comes down to. So your mileage may vary. I think I say that a lot, but you know, to me, The Fall Guy is just another example of Hollywood kind of disappearing up its own ass.
That may be. I had a fun time. You say it like it's a bad thing. I had a fun time. I think it's a great popcorn picture. I think it's a great summer movie. I can't wait to see it on a plane in 6 months.
You're going to watch that thing again, really?
With a big smile on my face.
All right. Well,
and maybe a little tear in my eye because of lack of oxygen, or maybe too much oxygen.
Yeah, or because you or because you've eaten a gummy before the flight. All right, Stephen Garrett. Well, we're gonna talk to you about Planet of the Apes, the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, in just a few minutes. So please stand by. Through the magic of podcasting, we're gonna make it look like this is one continuous conversation.
All the leaves are brown.
John Sugar.
And the sky is gray.
I'm a private investigator.
They told me that you do one thing and one thing only. You find the missing.
On such a winter's day,
One of the most interesting and surprising shows on streaming TV this year is Sugar, which is airing on Apple TV Plus. And we thought when it started that it was a kind of a homage to film noir, to classic Sam Spade, Philip Marlowe style detective shows and stories. It stars Colin Farrell as a PI named John Sugar, but it's turned into something else quite entirely. And Chris Farnsworth wrote about it initially for us before we learned this twist, but he's here now post-twist to talk about it with me. Hello, Chris.
Hey, how you doing, Neil?
I am good. So you wrote the initial review of Sugar after the first couple of episodes came out, and then we had one of our contributors, Cesare Strusewicz, who did not join us today because he lives in China, and that just would have been logistically a very, very, no, or, yeah, he lives in China or Japan. He lives in China or Japan, but regardless, it would have been very difficult for him to join us.
It's a long
us.
Way, either way.
Certainly not in person, and even on recording, a little difficult, but, you know, you have been following the show, and he wrote about this twist, and let's not sugarcoat it, as it were. Let's not hide it anymore. The end of episode six, John Sugar, played by Colin Farrell, injects himself with some sort of something and turns into an alien.
Right.
A blue-green alien. And I guess, I've only watched the first three episodes, so I'm sort of watching the show with this sort of spoiler in mind. And you see, suddenly, a lot of the ways Colin Farrell was behaving in the early episodes makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I mean, I think it was very earned. I mean, and I really do think there are a lot of people out there who are watching the show who were outraged. But I liked it. I really liked it. And my friends and I, because we are all, you know, genre geeks and comic book heads. And I wrote a series of books about a vampire who works for the president. So I was like, around episode three, I was like, if he's an alien, man, I don't know. I was like, no, that can't be. That can't be. But then, yeah, no, it's the only thing that makes sense.
But it is. He's an alien. And, you know, Cesare, he's also a comic book geek. And, you know, as he pointed out, there are a lot of clues that indicate that this John Sugar character is actually John Jones, the Martian Manhunter from DC Comics. And it makes a lot of sense. Like he points out, John Sugar can't get drunk. Martian Manhunter can't get drunk. The Martian Manhunter is obsessed with sugar. He's addicted to Oreos. Well, something like Oreos.
Right. That's his big thing. The Martian Manhunter, for those who are not big geeks like us, came to Earth in the 1950s as a Martian, was accidentally drawn here by a professor named Professor Ertl, and who immediately died and couldn't get him home. And then he learned how to be a human being by watching old detective movies. And he decided, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become a detective and help these humans, which is exactly the same thing John Sugar has done. Like, his memories are literally clips from old detective movies.
Yeah, and the show cleverly shows clips from old detective movies that and they are exact copies of how he talks, of how he walks, of how he acts. And you know, he doesn't seem interested in a lot of the things that Earth people are interested in, like food and sex, and you know,
alcohol, drugs. He's stronger, he's tougher, he's faster. Yeah, by the end of episode six, you're like, he's clearly superhuman. He deflects a bullet with his bare hands.
He's clearly not of this world.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, it's very obvious by the end of episode six, but it all really does fit well together. And at first I was like, there's no way this possibly could be what it looks like, but it is. And I think it works really well. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, no, I think it's really good. And, you know, the one thing I would say that it confuses me a little bit, and I think they're going to reveal all this, is that there's like a society of Martians, right? Like either episode three, he goes to this party and his handler is clearly not just someone who's like, you know, gives him assignments.
Right.
Right. She's, you know, there's something else going on that the Martians are all here to observe. We assume they're Martians. I guess they could double twist it and not have him be the Martian Manhunter. Although I don't see why, since he looks like him and has all the character traits of
yeah. Aside from the coloring, he looks very much like him. And I don't think that they're. I mean, I don't think, obviously it's not a Warner's production, so they're not actually. But I think there's a lot of inspiration there.
Well, and then another thing that our other writer pointed out is that the guy who is running the show has a superhero background and was you know, is connected with James Gunn, who is taking over the DC universe cinematically. And, but it's odd because this is on Apple TV and not on Max, which is where the Warner Universe is going. But maybe there's some sort of side deal. I don't know.
Maybe I would be so happy if that were true. But I think it stands alone on its own. I think it really does come across. I mean, did you ever see the Man Who Fell to Earth, the remake on Showtime?
Yeah, right.
That was one of my favorite shows of the last 5 years. I loved every bit of it, and I wished it had gotten, 10 seasons. And I see a lot of this in that.
Yeah, I mean, it is, the thing is, without the twist, I think it's still pretty good. Like, it's still a pretty good take on the private eye genre of the gumshoe model. Colin Farrell is extremely appealing and magnetic, and there's a lot of good supporting actors. James Cromwell, Amy Ryan.
I was amazed. Even the henchmen, all the way down to the henchmen, are good actors. Everybody is solid.
You probably know this. I don't really love the disjointed narrative, and there's like stuff that there's scenes that are going on simultaneously. Yes. There's some flashbacky stuff that I don't love. Although it does feel very comic booky. The one thing I will say is it sort of works in this show because Sugar's brain is clearly not normal.
At first, I thought the camera angle was just a little pretentious, like, oh, look what we're doing. But no, I really do believe I believe everything about the show is intentional. I think that at the very least I think even the haters would have to say they put an enormous amount of thought into it. And I love to see somebody doing that kind of work, because so many things, even in prestige TV seem just slapped together and they're like, we have, we've got 8 episodes, we'll get around to it. This is really well thought out.
Well crafted. And, that is one of the most kind of surprising twists I've seen in a TV show in a long time.
Yeah, me too. And I'm really happy to see people taking big swings.
Yeah. Even my wife, who could give a crap about superheroes and comic books, she was like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I think Colin Farrell is doing a magnificent job.
Yeah, really good. And the Martian Manhunter, there has been a live action Martian Manhunter because he was a character on Supergirl.
Right.
But that show, for all its kind of cheesy charm, was, very hacky.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I think Martian Manhunter is a great character to look at people with. I think the way they're the way Sugar is doing it is probably the way it should be done. The compassion, Colin Farrell is showing for people in this show is remarkable. He's literally begging the bad guys, don't make me hurt you. And he sold it. He made it look so real.
Yeah, it's a great performance. The best Martian Manhunter is still obviously from the animated Justice League Unlimited. That's, you can do anything you want. And that's probably the best superhero show ever made.
Yes.
Animated or not. Agreed. But in terms of live action, I hope that's who this is.
I would be so happy.
It would make a lot of sense. Again, like, I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on with the other Martians, because the whole point of the Martian Manhunter is that he's alone or basically alone.
Well, in Justice League, there were the white Martians who were evil.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then in Young Justice, you had Miss Martian.
Right, right. His sidekick.
Why do I know this? Why do I know this, Chris?
Grown men.
I'm a 54-year-old man, goddammit. I shouldn't know this. Why do I know this? Maybe we're Martians. Maybe that, oh my
Maybe
God.
That's it.
That's why my hand's been twitching.
It's not just age.
It's not, well, it might be. Maybe, but regardless of whether or not Chris and I are incredible dorks who have no life, Sugar is airing on Apple Plus, and I'm guessing, I don't know how many episodes are left in the season, Chris?
I think just 2, isn't it, to 8?
Okay, so it's an 8 episode season. So I all or at least some will be revealed in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
We've given away the spoiler, but honestly, like I'm behind and I've been watching this with the spoiler in mind. It actually makes the show richer, I think, knowing what's coming. It gives it even more depth and texture. So highly recommended from Book and Film Globe. Chris Farnsworth, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Noah, you choose a human over ape. Bear witness.
I must save my family.
We'll have to move fast.
Hold on! Together, you will die. Together, strong.
Stephen Garrett is back. He has not just been sitting here for 20 minutes waiting for me to call him again through the magic of podcasting. I like to explain to you all how this works. I recorded my interview with Stephen about The Fall Guy a few days ago, and now I'm recording an interview with Stephen about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which we have both seen in the days that have followed our first conversation, and we both have lots of fun to make about Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes.
I wish I had fun. It was pretty weak. It was weak.
You know, that's the thing. It's weak. It's weak. And, you know, the main ape in this movie is named Noah, N-O-A, not N-O-A-H. He's pretty weak.
Pretty weak.
He spends a lot of time falling down.
He falls down a lot.
And he's dumb. They're talking about how smart he is, but he's not. He's nice. He's nice. Here's my main problem with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes and all of these new Planet of the Apes movies. This is the fourth in an interminable series. Is that they're not fun to watch.
Yeah, brooding. I mean, and I think that was Matt Reeves, right? Who kind of set that brooding tone at the beginning, you know. Not fun.
Not fun. But what Matt Reeves did is he set up an origin story for the Planet of the Apes. It's basically like, a virus is unleashed that makes the apes smart and makes people stupid. And the apes gradually, over the course of almost 9 hours, take over the planet. So here we are. Several generations later, and you know, you're hoping that maybe you get the Planet of the Apes that we used to like, where the apes lived in cool houses and wore leather jackets, and you know, we're kind of groovy.
They were super groovy. They the whole planet wears apes. It was great.
Yeah, but that's not what we get here. It's still the same old, like, they're sort of evolved. Like, they can build structures, and they can train eagles with song. Which is very Avatar.
But you're right. It's still pretty primitive. It's pretty Middle Ages.
At best. And on top of that, spoiler alert, the smart humans who were supposed to have been wiped out are apparently still around.
And still smart.
And still have good technology, really, when it comes down to it. So you're really still dealing with the original premise. And it's like, when are we going to... It's going to take... thousands of years. I don't have thousands of years to get to back to the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
You know,
to
get back to Roddy McDowell and Kim Hunter and their groovy leather jackets or whatever. You know, it's like, you know, and those apes in Planet of the Apes, they had guns that they invented themselves.
Right.
Did they have cars? I think they just rode horses, which is fine.
I think they just rode horses. It's not like the Flintstones, like the ape version of that, where they have cars and things. Yeah.
No, but you know, these apes, and this thing is like, these apes ride horses. So they have sort of some rudiment. They have some crude weapons. You know, they're able to build things,
but they're still naked. They have crowns, I guess, and masks, right? But yeah, where's the groovy clothes?
They have blankets. They wear feathers and like blankets. Like they're the apes in Noah's tribe are like they're like, you know, Mesoamerican. You know, they're sort of noble savages, and then there's this tribe of, you know, dumb warlike apes. Who I guess, as you pointed out in your review, live in San Diego.
Yeah, they pretty much live in San Diego.
If I lived in San Diego, well, you don't have to go to the zoo anymore. That's out. It explains why there's zebras walking all over the place. But, you know, you'd maybe go surfing, go to a Padres game, you know, go grab some fish tacos. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe a nice Comic-Con.
Comic-Con, yeah. and you know what's odd is, like, the original movies, they all took place basically in, like, San Francisco.
No. Hey, not the first one. That was because Statue of Liberty. That was clearly the Metro.
No. Yeah, I mean the Charlton Heston one. Yeah. Yes, but I'm talking about the reboots.
Yeah.
Those took place in San Francisco, subsequent movies were like so. Obviously, like they've migrated south to Southern California.
Right.
You know, not Bakersfield.
But this is, you know what kind of bummed me out? This is what I don't understand. Okay, so you're a primitive human and you've been rendered mute and stupid because of this virus, right?
Right.
And yet you're wearing clothes like you just came off the set of like a Raquel Welch caveman movie, right? Mm. Like what are these loincloths that are from the mid-50s? Like it's mid-century loincloth time. Yeah. I don't understand that. And then, of course, Nova, which I wrote about in the review, she looks like she just stepped out of, Urban Outfitters with her
gorgeous skin,
jeans and stuff.
Especially, I mean, just dirty. She's dirty. She's dirty initially, but then I just kept
there's a Sephora. Like, there's definitely a Sephora nearby that she's raiding.
I'm just like, boy, Nova sure is cute.
Yeah. I mean, it was fine for Nova to be cute when she was talking to Charlton Heston. She had that caveman cute, which was very mid-century, no, but
this was more like, is this one of the kids from Divergent?
Right, exactly. Like, what is happening? These are superficial things, but they infect the story, and they kind of, I think, for me, reveals like, you know, bigger problems about these kind of alighting over bigger issues in the storytelling that just don't make sense. William H. Macy, where the hell did he come from?
The movies don't have the courage to go full Planet of the Apes. It's like, the people are still kind of going to win here, you know? Maybe. Yeah. Maybe, or it's gonna be like kind of a fair fight. And the whole point of Planet of the Apes is that the apes won, because we blew it all to hell. So these movies are just weak. So there's a couple other points. Well, first of all, the one character I did like was the wise old orangutan who lived underground.
Who is maybe somewhere. Gay? Here's an interesting plot twist where he was like, he was my village. He points to the burnt out pyre. He still has his friend's bones?
Yeah, he still has the skeleton, even though many generations have passed. I guess it's kind of a weak fire if those bones haven't burned up, right?
Yeah, he was kind of a groovy guy.
You all don't even have to know what we're talking about. It's
just he had a groovy stupid medallion. I liked his medallion.
Groovy medallion. He apparently was like a wise old librarian, like a Yoda. He was kind of like a big Yoda.
He was like a big Yoda, and then it gets washed away in the water when he's screaming like, stronger together, bye.
Bye. There's no reason for that character to die. Totally useless.
Yeah, why did they kill him? I don't understand.
And Noah didn't even really know him, didn't really care about him. He didn't react to the fact that his friend died. He didn't care. Yeah. And then, William H. Macy, out of nowhere.
What is his story? Like, why is he alone? And why do the apes tolerate him? Because he knows what might be in the bunker?
How does he know who Kurt Vonnegut is? How? How would he possibly know?
How would they possibly?
And even if he had read the book, he still wouldn't know who Kurt Vonnegut was. Many generations have passed.
Many generations.
You know, our society, I'm guessing, is not going to be wiped out by an ape virus, and people still aren't going to know who Kurt Vonnegut is in many generations. Much less a wise old. He wasn't even that wise. He was just a guy, you know, who was living. He was living among the apes.
So odd. I don't understand him.
Yeah, a very strange character. So, look, the whole thing, this whole movie is just dumb as dirt.
Well, look, and I, you know, spoiler, like when the big climax comes and the apes conjure the birds to attack, Proxima Caesar, when they start doing this, it sounds like Wolf of Wall Street, this weird chant that they're suddenly doing, which you never hear in the movie before until this moment.
They sort of were starting to chant it at the beginning. But then they never got around.
They never really got around to it. And what does that chant mean? Bird attack this random ape guy. Like all the birds suddenly turn hostile. Like it's like a Hitchcock movie. It's weird.
The problem is I didn't like any of the characters except for the wise old orangutan. His name was Rocco or something. Roku. What was his name?
Roku. Rocka? Roku.
Rocka? Rocco.
Riff Raff? I don't know. Something like that. Rock and roll.
He was kind of fun. Noah is a complete... he's just a
nothing burger.
Boring and bland.
Dumb.
He's dumb. His friends are dumb. May is cute to look at, but not very.
They're totally implausible. It doesn't make sense. Why would she, if her big secret strategy was to break into this bunker in San Diego, why the hell is she hanging out in Los Angeles? Did she get separated from a bigger group of humans?
Yeah, they were all killed. You know, they might have gotten lost. Maybe their GPS sent them the wrong direction.
God. But I mean, she's very intimate about that bunker. Why didn't she like? I don't know.
How do they know? Let's be clear: San Diego and Los Angeles, you know, in terms of the world at large, are fairly close together. But they seem to just be able to go through some tunnel and get to San Diego.
They're pretty fast. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like even with no traffic, which
it still takes
an hour and 20
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, it's a good
and the best thing about this world is no traffic.
Lots of horsepower though.
And there aren't even a lot of apes. There's like 200 or 300. No. This is Southern California we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and spoiler alert, at the end, the humans communicate with some outpost in Indiana.
That's so odd.
Like, oh,
what the
hell? Have the apes not taken over? I mean, if I were an ape, I wouldn't want to go anywhere near Indiana.
No, you're coastal. Because of
the politics. Like, yeah, it's the politics, you know, just the it's general. It's cold. It's. I know that they have fur, but it gets cold in the winter. You know, you'd stay. You'd probably want to stay west, you know, west coast.
Okay, but, maybe you know, I'm scratching my head like a primate trying to figure out why the hell I keep making these movies. And I guess I will say it's dazzling. I want to say something positive. The visual effects are insane. They're gorgeous. Like
super immersive. I was immersed in it and I was ready to buy into it because it was like, I'm like, this is basically like a movie with no humans and just a bunch of talking apes and you're buying it. But then the humans show up and suddenly you're like, what are they?
It really kind of ruins it. I was so in for the egg story in the first 20 minutes.
Yes, the first 20 minutes are great.
This is really well paced and they're really focused on eggs. And I guess this is the story and I'm into it.
Well, and the first 20 minutes were good. And then they decided to, it became sort of the same movie that the other movies have been. And again, no groovy leather jackets, no like futuristic houses.
Or hats, that weird hat that Dr. Zaius wore.
No, and no Dr. Zaius. You're on the fourth freaking movie. Where is Dr. Zaius? Where?
Come on, guys. You're milking it.
Yeah, stop it. Because at some point, people are going to lose interest. I'm hoping that's now, but it's...
It may take many generations for people to lose interest, apparently.
Many, many, many generations. All right, Steven, you wise old orangutan, you. I'm going to let you go. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is in... theaters now. Enter if you like watching CGI animated talking chimpanzees.
This is the best one of those out right now, in that it's the only one.
Yeah, it's top of the chart, but it still doesn't feature King Kong whipping a baby monkey around his head, hitting another
King Kong. That's true, actually. Oh yeah, I guess that's still in theaters. Go see that.
Enough with them. I'm done monkeying around in the theater for the summer. Hey yo, all right, Stephen Garrett. Talk to you later.
Yep.
All right, thank you very much, Stephen Garrett. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is now playing in theaters everywhere. Critics together strong. Also thanks to Stephen for talking to me about The Fall Guy, which is also still in theaters and will soon be on streaming somewhere near you. Thanks also to Chris Farnsworth for talking to me about Sugar, which is on Apple TV Plus. That show still has many mysteries to reveal, and I recommend it quite highly, actually. I find it very entertaining. Very thought-provoking, very moody, and relaxing in a weird way. So Sugar is recommended by Book and Film Globe. Not so much The Fall Guy and Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, but it's still fun to go to the movies, even if the movies aren't great. I'm Neil Pollack. I'm the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We publish fresh content nearly every day, and we bring you this program nearly every week, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.